The earth binds us potters to one another. Score, slip, and we're joined together throughout history. None of us are here today without one another. So I'd like to begin by paying homage to each of you and to this wonderful community of makers and creators. And of course, I want to pay homage to my teachers, my mentors, and my enablers. And we're going to push a button now. My wife, Judy, without her support and sacrifice, encouragement, and nagging, I would not be a potter today. Cynthia Bringle, Mary Nyberg, Bob Turner, Karen Carnes, and Michael Zakin, David Leach, Debbie Bedwell, Angela Fina, Elvira Peak, Robin Hopper, Vivica and Otto, and Jerry and Julie Williams. I've been waiting a very, very long time to thank all of these people publicly. Thank you. And then there's the clay. None of us would be here today without all of us struggling and surviving and making and creating and conferencing and meeting and drinking and dancing if it weren't for this living earth that sustains us, seduces us, and keeps us growing. Thanks to the clay and to all of those workers and makers throughout the millennia who have transformed the earth into beautiful and useful objects. They paved the path that leads us here today, and they made it possible for us to do what we do. So thanks must be given to our foremothers and forefathers in clay. Thanks to them. So how did I end up here? That's the title of the choice for this lecture. I've forgotten how many Ensikas I've attended, but I remember the first one. It was in 1979. It was in State College, Pennsylvania, in conjunction with SuperMud. I was living in D.C. and brand new to clay, and had just come back from a workshop with Cynthia Bringle in Penland. And Cynthia was in D.C. and staying with us for an opening at the American Hand in Georgetown. And during the opening, it started to snow, and it snowed, and it snowed, and it really, really snowed. And by halfway through the opening, we decided to leave. And by the time we got home, only a matter of blocks, we were snowed in. It was the blizzard of 1979. Well, Cynthia was very nervous because she was hot to trot and to get on the road and to go to Penn State. And she was going to Ensikah. I had never heard of Ensikah, but she told me about it. And I said, well, why not? It sounded, D.C. was shut down. I couldn't do any work there. So I bummed a ride, and I went to State College, Pennsylvania, to my first Ensikah, 1979. I had not heard of Ensikah when I arrived. I had not registered. I had no room. Cynthia's room was full. But she was so generous, and she's not here today for me to thank her, that she gave me the floor. And I spent my first Ensikah sleeping in her closet. Thank you, Cynthia. So I had no idea there were so many potters in the world, and they were all seemed to be right there in State College, Pennsylvania. I remember very little about the conference. The only thing I remember were the demonstrations. I didn't know any of the people at the time. But on the stage was this woman, this little woman. She had a kerchief on, a scarf on her head, and she was sitting at the wheel, and she was throwing from a mound of clay a beautiful pot without a bottom. So I was stunned by the vitality and the scale of this pot, but I had no idea why in the world anybody would throw a pot without a bottom. And so when she finished, she stood up, she cut it off, she grabbed the pot off the wheel and threw it on the floor and stretched it and stretched it and stretched it. I was aghast. I actually thought it blasphemous to take that beautiful pot and throw it on the floor. This woman must be mad. But at the end of the demonstration, there stood up on the stage the most remarkable pot I had ever seen up to that point in my life. Thank you, Betty Woodman. 30 years later, I wonder what magical memories we will all take home with us from this conference. I will remember sitting in my room and practicing this damn speech. But I wonder what you will remember 30 years hence. In 30 years, what will you remember from this? Those who preceded me to give this closing lecture have been major figures in our field, and it makes me really nervous to be here. I'm very intimidated, and there's no way that I could fill their shoes. I'm not an academic. and I will avoid all academics, art speak. There will be no talk of art versus craft or skill versus intent. And the only mention of postmodernism is now. It's done. I am a potter. And I suspect I am the first studio potter that has ever been asked to give the closing lecture. And I have nothing more to offer you than my story, my journey, my transfiguration by the clay and by fire. If you've heard of me at all, it's probably as that crazy Shino addict, hooked on smoke and soot, obsessed with trapping those elusive carbon molecules in the early melting soda ash. Several years ago at the Minnesota Pottery Tour, a woman came up to me and looked at my name tag, and she said, "Oh, my God, Malcolm Davis, I thought you were a glaze." So I am here. I think this is why I accepted this assignment. I'm here in the flesh to say I am not a glaze. And I am more than a name on a bucket. I'm a man with a history and a story to tell, so I'm going to tell it now. Our journeys of transformation. We all have journeys of transformation, and the clay hasn't transformed each and every one of us. We came to Enseca, each of us have come here along a different path, and each on our own journey. But we all are here because of our common love for and addiction to this material called clay. Whether makers or users, potters or sculptors, installation artists, collectors or critics, shop owners, gallery owners, museum directors, authors or scholars, it is the material of clay that has attracted us, that inspires us, and that captures our imaginations and our passions. Some of us are nearing the end of this journey, and others are midstream, and many, many of you are at the very beginning. But Enseca brings us all together from all over the world, both young and old, as comrades and colleagues. And I want to thank Enseca for being a forum and a framework, a source of knowledge, of information, of criticism, for providing a context that we can come together and forge friendships. It has been said of me that I came to clay through the back door, that I didn't pursue the normal channels and never paid my dues. And actually, the dues have been paid. But they were right. I didn't follow any prescribed, accepted steps to reach this place. For me, it was one step at a time. Each door opened the next. There was a lot of luck, a lot of serendipity, and a lot of good fortune. But I have no MFA, I have no BFA, I have no formal training. In fact, the only art class I ever took, one, was in high school. And I wanted to get an easy A so I could give the graduation speech, the valedictory, right? Well, I didn't get that A, and I didn't give the speech. I didn't get a C, I got an F. I flunked art. And as I like to say, a flunking F. My friends will know what I'm trying to say. From then on, I avoided art at every encounter. I was 40 years old when I touched clay for the first time, and it changed my life forever. So I want to speak here today on behalf of all of you who came to clay late in life, having completed your educations. There are a lot of you. After you've completed your educations and had your lives, your families, your jobs, your careers, your homes, I want to speak on behalf of all of you who came in through the back door or the side door, who snuck in when no one was looking, who avoided formal training and technical training. I am one of you, and we are everywhere. So how did I end up here? It was not in the plan, I assure you. Born in 1937 in Virginia's Tidewater, on the shores of the Chesapeake, I knew nothing of clay. God, the images are down here. I knew nothing of clay. Our family's dishes were Lennox, not a handmade pot in the lot. I went to William & Mary, and I didn't even know there was an art department there until decades later. And from there, I graduated in 1959 with a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics. And that was the year the Russians sent Sputnik into space, and the space war was on, and mathematicians were in great demand. So I had job offers up the kazoo, and of course, I picked the one that offered me the most money and packed my bags and headed to Hartford, Connecticut to become an insurance actuary. Life number one. Plan number one. Climb the golden ladder up to the executive suite and rule Hartford as an insurance magnate. Why not? However, when they showed me my office, it was a cubicle in the middle of a room, stacked with this huge stack of massive black ledgers and an equally massive black manual adding machine. 1950, what is this? Anyway, I knew something was dreadfully wrong. I mean, dreadfully wrong, so 3 days later, I was gone. That was plan one. Plan two, seminary, why not? Made sense. The life of a bishop would be almost as good as that of an insurance magnate. Plus, there were costumes, rings, you know, all these little perks. So early on, I entered Union Theological Seminary in the fall of 1959 in New York City on Morningside Heights. And I immediately joined the Social Action Committee because I wanted to meet women. And I figured there'd be a lot of socializing, social action, and action, you know, an action, a lot of action. I told them I wasn't going to pick my nose. Anyway, I was dead wrong. The Social Action Committee was a bunch of guys committed to social change and social justice. And within weeks, I was picketing Woolworths in Harlem to protest this policy of segregated lunch counters in the South. And before I knew it, I had become a radical. And radicals didn't become bishops. I needed another plan. So I graduated, I married my seminary sweetheart, I got ordained in the United Church of Christ, and became a campus minister. Moving to Washington, D.C. in 1965 as the ecumenical chaplain at the George Washington University. The 60s were exciting, turbulent, transformative years. Richard Nixon was in the White House down the street. Across from my office was the national headquarters of the Selective Service System, the draft, and General Louis B. Hershey, if anyone's old enough to remember. And J. Edgar Hoover was chairman of the Board of Trustees of the university. So we were literally in the belly of the beast. I soon joined the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and became one of the few white volunteers to work with Martin Luther King and his staff to plan the 1968 March on Washington, the 1968 Poor People's Campaign. But Martin was murdered on April the 4th in Memphis, almost 42 years to the day from this very moment, April the 4th. And all hell broke loose. Rebellions broke out across the land. Washington, D.C. was in flames and under curfew. Federal troops and tanks patrolled our streets and our neighborhoods up and down with their turrets aimed in our bedroom windows. But the Poor People's March continued. And the first mule train arrived in Washington 3 weeks later. Thousands came by car, by foot, by train, by bus, by mule trains and huge horse-drawn caravans from all over the country. On the National Mall, they built a shanty town of tents and cardboard boxes from recycled, scavenged plywood and scrap metal. And they called it Resurrection City. And they camped there for 6 weeks. They were unemployed, welfare mothers, welfare activists, migrant laborers and farm workers, nursemaids and gardeners, blacks and Hispanics, Native and white Americans from all over the country, all demanding to be heard, to be respected, demanding jobs, income, and economic justice. It was a multiracial army of the poor. And it rained, and it rained, and it rained. And the conditions were miserable. And in June, Bobby Kennedy was killed. And it seemed like all hope was extinguished. And many of us became disillusioned and turned to more radical solutions. My campus ministry was renamed the People's Union. And we joined the mobilization against the war in Southeast Asia. We joined the Women's Liberation Movement, the Black Panther Party. And later, we joined more radical pre-communist caucuses. We wanted to remake the world. We wanted to end racism and sexism, to end imperialism and militarism, to stamp out homophobia and all chauvinisms. We wanted to create institutions that serve the people and not profit. My campus ministry ran a draft counseling center and started a network of food co-ops, helped to organize free health clinics in the inner city all over D.C., and was involved in the formation of the Rape Crisis Center. It was a heady time, full of energy and hope. We knew we were going to build a new society. We knew we were going to create a society of, for, and by the people. Unfortunately, the old society had other ideas, and it wasn't about to give up any power or control. My office was bombed. Our house was bugged. There were weeks that we had helicopters just circling our backyard. And out front, we had our FBI agent sitting in his car, reading the paper and drinking coffee. And I later found out that I was one of the five Davises on Richard Nixon's notorious enemies list. American citizens to be detained and tagged for detention in the event that Richard Nixon would declare a state of national emergency. I was approaching 40 years old. I was already burned out and frightened. So one night, a neighbor asked me to go to an adult education meeting. I had five or six meetings that night. I didn't want to go to any of them, so I went. And it was just, I didn't have to do anything, and it was not a meeting. It was going to be like a lecture, I thought. When we arrived, the instructor was at the door, and he gave everybody a bag of clay. I didn't know anything about clay. I was in my 40s. I had never touched clay in my life, and I wasn't about to touch clay that night. So I went and sat down. In fact, I thought it was counter-revolutionary, the fact that grown adults would be spending an evening playing with clay when this country was waging an illegal and moral war in Southeast Asia. I just found it appalling. So I sat there and just judged them, and then but they didn't seem to care. There they were. All of these counter-revolutionaries standing around the table, slabbing and stretching and coiling and paddling and pinching and pressing and creating objects out of nothing. And I must say, I was intrigued. And I gathered my courage, and I went up and I asked for my bag of clay. And I took it out, and I rolled what I later learned was a coil. And I formed it over a bowl that was upside down on the table. And when I turned it upside down, and the coils came out, and I had a bowl. I had made something. It was concrete. It was tangible. It was real. It was immediate. It was nothing like saving souls or overthrowing capitalism. I could hardly wait until the next class to take the next step. And at the end of the session, I went home with my very own glaze-fired soap dish, which is on our kitchen counter to this day. When I first took that slimy, greasy, wet ball of clay out of that plastic bag, I knew that something had snapped. I knew that something was out, and it wasn't just the clay. I knew right then and there that I was a potter. I might have been a potter all my life. I might have been a potter in another life, but how would I have ever known if I hadn't touched that ball of clay? The problem, of course, was I didn't know how to make a pot. Sort of an awkward situation. So I began to take classes, every possible class that I could take. I went to Haystack that summer in 1973. And in 1968, I spent the summer in Penland as a weekend cook. And one of the sessions was taught by a porcelain potter who got rid of all the stoneware in the studio and made us all work with porcelain. And bingo, transformation. I was a porcelain potter. Right then and there, never touched stoneware again. Finally, in 1982, at age 45, I resigned my job as a campus minister. I rented a house and studio down in Pentland and spent 3 years trying to learn to make pots, while Judy stayed back home in D.C. and supported us. I didn't know how to fire a kiln, and I had no idea how to start a business, but I knew I wanted to make pots. I didn't want to play at it. I wanted to make pots. I wanted, if I was going to give up my life and my career and my housing allowance and my insurance and my health insurance and my annuity and all of that, I was going to be serious. I had to do it. I wanted to make pots. I wanted to make the best pots I could. I wanted to make useful pots. I wanted to make honest pots. I wanted to make my pots. I spent 3 years in that basement studio working around the clock, weekends and holidays. I had only 500 pounds of porcelain, and I worked it until all life was gone from it. I threw it, reprocessed it, threw it, and reprocessed it, keeping only those few things that I liked, but not very often. I really resisted trying to allowing myself to fall in love with each piece. Somehow I knew that each step, each pot, was a part of a long discovery and of finding my way. I think I fired one biscuit that entire first year. The most difficult thing for me was to clear out all that strong influence from all those people I had studied under so that my own spirit would emerge in my pods. So I decided I would just take one form and use and work on it for a month. So I chose a tea bowl. For 1 month, I threw tea bowls off of a hump of clay, still working with that 500 pounds of clay. And at first, it was very exciting. I mean, tall ones. I tried to make everyone different, tall ones and wide ones and skinny ones and fat ones and, you know, concave ones and full ones and summer bowls and winter bowls. And I mean, and then I ran out of ideas, and then I got terribly bored. Who would have ever thought a month could be so long? I mean, it was like 10 days and I was ready to quit. And so, but I had 20 more days to go, so I persevered. And that's when things started to happen. When I was no longer trying, when I was no longer trying to be fresh, new, and all of that, something inside took over and new things began to emerge, new pots, my pots. So slowly, pots began to pile up. And I was out, I was using up that 500 pounds of clay, so I had to buy more clay. That meant I had to sell pots. That meant I had to learn how to fire the kiln. So I learned how to fire the kiln, sort of. I fired, for 3 years, I was firing that kiln, making what I thought was great pots, and what at the time. And I thought I was, because I was firing in a gas kiln, I thought I was reducing them. But actually, they were all oxidized. I thought, you know, that electric was oxidized, gas was reduced. So how did I know that you could oxidize a gas kiln? But those were, I liked those pots. I can't get them again because now I know what reduction is. Anyway, so then I had to start applying to shows if I was going to sell things. And then all of that stuff, slides, applications, and getting rejected. You know, having to deal with rejections, you know, weekly rejections, regular rejections, steady rejections. It's not confidence building. So anyway, I finally got into a show. It was an ACC, American Craft Council show in Dallas, Texas. As it turned out, the last one they ever had. And it's not my fault. And it was Palm Sunday weekend, so I decided I was going to make Easter eggs. So I threw all these little closed forms off the hump, decorated them, and sold them in little baskets from Pier 1. And they were a great hit. But one night when I was tired and I was making them, I just trimmed like 24 or 30 of these little buggers, and I was carrying them across the floor in my rail board, tripped, and they all went flying, you know, all over the place, plop, 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 plop. And I was, you know, how many hours had I been trimming those buggers? So I sat down on the floor and just tried. I mean, cried and cried and cried, and then I noticed they hadn't popped open. They're all over the floor with these little, it was like one of these sculptures we've been looking at, like all over these, it was an installation piece. I didn't realize it until tonight, until right now. Anyway, so I thought, wow, I'm not going to waste them. So I turned them into little bud vases, cut a hole in the back to hang them on the wall, and a little top to put the posies in. I took them off to the trade show, and they were a hit. I sold out, and I came home with order for 600 of those things. I spent the next month in my studio throwing little closed forms and throwing them all over the studio. You had to kind of maneuver, like walk around. Because you know, I had to leave them there until they set up and stuff, or I would have ruined them. So I was like a, you know, obstacle course. That's a lesson there. Be careful what you ever take to a trade show. Eventually, I came up with a production line. I called it my white shit. And it was porcelain pots, wet faceted while still on the wheel, a slip trailed decoration with my throwing slip, and I fired them with my clear glaze. So it was white on white and white, and they were quite nice. And I went off to my first major trade show in Springfield, Massachusetts, and I came home with $40,000 worth of orders. I was so excited. I had it made. I had orders from Macy's and shops and galleries and all over the country. Finally, I had hit the big time. I was going to be able to support her. Judy could stop working. So that never happened. She's still working. When I told my landlady of my success, she said, well, she smiled. I said, well, that's wonderful, but you can't make them here. Because I don't want my, you know, I don't want to use this as production pottery. You have to find your own place. So there I was, out on my ass with $40,000 worth of pots to make and nowhere to make them. But, and this is part of the story of how we survive and how we keep going. We can't do it without some luck and good fortune and friends. And that came to me at that point in my life in the form of Debbie Bedwell. And Debbie was able to get me a grant from the NEA to spend a year at Baltimore Clay Works on a residency. And I was able to begin filling those orders. But it didn't take me long to get very tired of filling, you know, making pots to order forms, you know, to other people's demands. It just didn't work for me. Plus, kill load after kill load after kill load of that white shit got very, very boring. And if there was one iron spot on it, nobody would take it. So I was looking for another surface. One of the other potters at Clay Works had been experimenting with something called Shino. Now, I knew of Shino because Angela had worked with it and said, don't do it. You will never be able to make it or sell it. So, but there they were. They were in the trash, were 24, 25 little pellets of dried up Shino tests. She had them in little Dixie cups. She'd thrown them in the trash, unlabeled. So I took all these 24 different tests, put them in a little bucket, added enough water, and I put a jar in it, and I rolled it. And so I could coat that jar with this mix of Shino glazes. And when I put it in a kiln that somebody else was firing, the next kiln, and when it came out of that kiln, I was amazed. It was dynamite, and it's on the screen, right? It was my first Shino pot, and it was full of, you know, it was salmony and orange and peachy and had all these crystals, these black and gray spots, big ones and little ones. I had no idea what it was. Someone said it was carbon trapping, but that meant nothing to me. I'd never heard the word before in my life. I didn't care. I just wanted more. So that kicked me off on my eternal search to get that surface again. And I'm still trying. I've never gotten it again. And if you think I'm going to tell you how to do it, you're wrong. Not here and not now. But you can come to La Meridiana this fall with me in Tuscany. We're going to trap soot. We're going to trap Tuscan soot, and we're going to do it. So in 1985, I set up my own studio at the top of a remote West Virginia mountaintop at the end of a winding, dirt, steep road. I thought my journey was over. I had a studio of sorts. I had a kiln, and I could just make pots. How wonderful. So these are a couple of shots of my studio in 1985 as I bought it. The white building is my kiln shed. I'm firing my very first kiln. You can see the flame in there. The red building was my studio. It used to be a pigsty. It had no heat, no floor. It had a few windows, and I worked in there until just recently. Next slide. That's the inside. The only part that was not dirt was where the wheel was. And eventually I knew I needed another studio when the floor went through. And I was sitting at the wheel, and all of a sudden the chair went through the floor. And the wheel was at my nose level, and I was in the hole. So the groundhogs had built worlds under there. Ethel is my black snake who lived in those hollow red bricks. And she left every morning at 10, came back every day at 5. She was 8 feet long. And 5 years ago, I finally was able to build me a proper studio. And that's the next slide. And it's nothing fancy, but it's got a floor. It's got windows. It's got heat. It's got running water. And it has a toilet. Once I got to West Virginia and I started trying to make a living off of my pots in my own studio, that's when all the shit started to happen, and all of these problems that we potters know all too well started happening to me. Blown up pots, S-cracks, running glazes all over the shelves, crawling, crazing, pop-outs, pinholes, dunting, shivering, slaking. I mean, no one ever told me about these things. It was not in any of my workshops. And so, and then there were bad backs, of course. And there was that time that I washed all of my shelves with my clear glaze. And there was a time when UPS went off the side of a mountain with $50,000 worth of holiday pods. And then I could go and tell horror stories maybe next year. We can just have a thing on what can go wrong, why you should not be a potter. And in 1994, there was a major studio fire. But my greatest personal struggle, and about the fire, is Janet Leach told me, that's wonderful because that means you're a potter. No potter can be a potter unless they burn down their studio at least once. Bernard Leach burned his down twice. But my greatest personal struggle over the years has been to come to terms with the fact that I left the active struggle for social justice to make pots and dishes for the privileged. Why do we make pots? Why do we work with clay? How do we justify it? Does it serve any useful social function? Is it merely self-indulgence, escapism, egotism, privilege? Is our work with clay just selfish, useless, and superfluous? What difference does clay make anyway? What difference does clay make? What difference does clay make? I mean, I asked myself over and over. So I sent that question in an email to about 30 potter friends, critics, curators. And the response was overwhelming. And it's clear that clay has made a difference in all of their lives. But I continue to grapple with this question as I continue to make pots. And I really can do no other. For me, this journey is not one of choice, but one of destiny. What we do with the clay, and what we create with our hands, and what we offer up from our spirits may not end racism or end injustice, but it just may help keep the culture human. A recent email from a friend read, "Art cannot cure cancer, but art restores hope." Perhaps that's one of the things that we have to offer, hope. When I was handed that first dirty ball of clay, I was at the time deeply involved in the struggle for social change and social justice. But my encounter with clay was dramatic. It was radical. It was life-changing. Something unknown within me was touched, exposed, awakened, and set free. There was no turning back, and I didn't want to turn back. I found a reservoir within that was deeper than I ever imagined I had. A creative spirit that could lead me to new places if I trusted it and just let go. I found within me a surprising and unknown sense of form, of grace, of elegance. I found part of myself that I had never met. Clay found me without my seeking it and grabbed me and took over my life. I was no longer the same man. And this same is true for most of you in this room. Clay has changed each of us in its own way and given each of us our own journey of transformation. I'm now 72 years old, and I'm still making pots and still wondering how it happened. I have no idea how this happened. And the pots. My first teapot. My first porcelain pots. They each weighed 5 pounds. They were 2 inches high, and they had S-cracks through every one of them. Some fool bought them, and I thought they were great, because if anybody buys them, that makes them good. My first porcelain teapot, I wanted the most perfect, beautiful porcelain pot you'd ever... I mean, and the, of course, the cone packs melted on the spout. How many times has that happened? Of course, I flunked art, so I wasn't about to do brushwork on pots, so I carved them. And then we carved them. And then I became aware of David Leitch's work, and I started doing fluting and faceting. Then I went to Alfred one summer to their summer program, and in the pot shop across the wall was a big sign that said, "A pot without soul is just clay around a hole." And I got home and I looked at my pots and I said, "That's just clay around a hole. It looks like it was made by a machine. It's just too perfect." So then I started making pots, throwing pots, and faceting them while they were still on the wheel, still being thrown, so that they would be fresher and have a little more vitality, life, energy in them. So these were early on. At some point, another one of those serendipitous moments that break in for no reason at all and change your life and open up doors and that make it possible to be what you want to be. And that, was for me, was an invitation from Karen Carnes to exhibit at the Old Church Cultural Center. It's a pottery invitational that she's been curating for 35 years in Demarest, New Jersey, on the first weekend in December, and it's the most magnificent venue of functional pots in the land. And I have been fortunate to be a part of it for 30 years. Thank you, Karen. I meant to take these out, and I forgot to. But anyway, at one workshop I did with Karen Carnes, she had us work with one pound of clay, 10 of them, and make 10 lidded vessels. And we were supposed to take 10 of them and look at the one which was the most successful in terms of scale, proportion, form, and all of that. It was a form workshop. And take that one of the 10, the best, that we liked the best, and translate it with 5 pounds of clay. Well, I couldn't work with 5 pounds of porcelain, so I went the other direction. So I started making these little covered vessels off the hump, and they were about 2 inches high. And so I couldn't sell them. I took them to shows, and I tried to sell them as cocaine jars, but no one would dare do it publicly, buy them. Just a pocket comb, so I could get 12 or 15 in each pocket. Anyway, let's keep going. This is my white, this is the white shit. It was a production line of just white pots, and they did very well. I mean, I could reproduce them if I didn't get iron spot firmly. And then you saw the first Shino pot that I did. When I discovered Shino and when I glazed that pot, with a glaze made out of 24 tests. There was no recipe. So I spent the next several years testing, trying to come up with a recipe that was going to give me those spots, that jar. Of course, I didn't know that, no, I would never get it because of the way carbon trapping works. You never can ever get the same thing. A couple of years ago, I got, thanks to Jim Bailey, a brand new gas kill, and I have not been able to get my red Shino to work, my ultra carbon trap Shino to work in this new kill. So I beginning to work with combinations of other Shinos, white Shinos, and lots of different Shinos. And that's what these are. These are not my Shino. It's sort of a marble Shino that just came out of the last. From the beginning of recorded time, humans have worked with clay to solve problems for food, for shelter, for storage, for cooking, the pursuit of beauty, and to make real the spirit world. Wonderful things have been done with just clay and fire. And it gives me goosebumps to go to the basement of the Freer Collection in Washington, D.C., and to actually hold that Jomon jar from 5,000 plus years ago. And in your hand, as you're holding, you can actually feel the marks of the maker's hand from 5,000 years ago. So this path that we travel goes way back. It goes back to the very beginning of human history. It goes back before the beginning of human history. From the Big Bang and the primordial ooze, the earth was formed and fermented as rocks became clay over eons of erosion, change, and weather. What a precious material, formed so very slowly over the millennia. And what a huge responsibility we have as clay workers to handle it with care and to use. Let us continue on that path and let us offer up the very best that we have to make good work, honest work, work that comes from the heart. We've been given a gift as makers and as creators, as well as a challenge and a charge and a responsibility. We have a responsibility as clay workers to carry on the tradition, to continue the work, and to honor and treat the clay as it deserves to be treated, with honesty and with integrity, with respect and with love. Martin Luther King once said that our lives begin the day we become silent about things that matter. Let us not be silent. Let us speak out. Let us speak out about things that matter. We speak out with what we create with our hands and our hearts. Let's speak out about those things that matter, the soul of the culture, the spirit of our culture, and what it means to be human. This closing lecture is not a summary of a marvelous gathering here in Philadelphia, but a transition from here, this convention hall, to there, your studios, your homes, your shops, your schools. Consider this a call to get home, clean up those studios, wedge that clay, and get back to work. I am. Now it's your turn.